Hi, my name is Ben Lightburn. I'm the CEO and co-founder of Filament Health, a naturally focused psychedelic drug development company. You're listening to Professionally Psychedelics.
Hello, listener, and welcome to the Professionally Psychedelics podcast. I am really pleased to say that joining me today is Ben Lightburn, the co-founder and CEO of Filament Health. Listed on the Neo Exchange, Filament Health have many irons in the psychedelic fire, spearheading clinical trials alongside the University of California, San Francisco, registering a whole host of IP, and making strides forward within drug discovery. As a company that favors naturally derived psychedelics rather than their synthetic counterparts, I cannot wait to dig under the bonnet here. So, without further ado, Ben, welcome to the Professionally Psychedelics podcast.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you. And Ben, as you all know, our first and customary question on the pod is, what led you to the plant or the plants?
Well, it's a great question, and if you'll bear with me, it's a bit of a long answer, and that's because I've more or less my entire career been working in botanical extracts. So that is the business and science and sometimes art of extracting high value compounds from natural plant sources, and obviously that includes fungal sources as well. Mm-hmm. My first job as a summer student in undergrad and university was in a lab manufacturing novel cancer APIs. So we were extracting this compound called cyclopamine from the plant called California corn lily, or Veratrum californicum. Is a very complicated alkaloid that was being used in novel cancer therapies. And so I just, for whatever reason, fell into this business. And after graduating from university, I got a full-time job at that company. Eventually I got a business degree. I joined another botanical extraction company, this time more focused on producing dietary supplements and also scaling a novel botanical extraction technology. So a technology that didn't use any harmful solvents in the manufacture of these kinds of ingredients, and then extracting plants and selling the extracts from all over the world to companies all over the world. And then eventually we sold that last company in the summer of 2018, and really, you know, after selling that company, was looking around for another project to do, and obviously with a keen eye on the I guess you could call the rise of the nascent psychedelics industry, it was really surprising that there didn't seem to be too many people focused on the natural extraction of these psychedelic compounds. As we know, they're all compounds, more or less all compounds that were discovered in nature, right? Even LSD was discovered from a fungus. And over time, it's just become commonplace to manufacture these substances synthetically, which is totally fine, right? We're not anti-synthetic. We're pro-natural, but we're not anti-synthetic. And that's because synthetic compounds have been shown to be safe and efficacious in clinical trials and have a great ability to help people. But we believe that, you know, something or several things are lost with synthetics. And first and foremost, that being that when you make a natural extract of a natural psychedelic plant or fungus, you're extracting much more than just the, you know, the primary single metabolite, which is all you manufacture when you make something synthetic. So the example is, you know, when you make a magic mushroom extract, you're extracting much more than just psilocybin. And it's very possible that over time we can prove with further clinical study that all these compounds that you extract from the magic mushroom together can have a performance benefit when compared to just synthetic isolated psilocybin. And that recognition is already considered the gospel truth in other industries such as the cannabis industry, right? You know, synthetic THC has been around for a very long time, but you know it's very clear that consumers prefer naturally extracted cannabinoids of all kinds. So that's kind of my long story. I sometimes feel as though the mushroom or the plant, you know, led me on this journey. Probably 10 or 15 years, I was making all different kinds of plant extracts: cranberry extract, green tea extract, blueberry extract, and I didn't really have that much, you know, frankly speaking, belief in the efficacy of these products. I mean, obviously it was a big market, right? The green tea extract market is huge. People love it. You know, it makes them feel better. But the, you know, it's a dietary supplement, the efficacy, the proof really isn't there for a lot of these products. So the opportunity to work on, to bring all of that knowledge, plugging away, making, you know, Veratrum Californicum extract and blueberry extract and cranberry extract, and the opportunity to work together with my colleagues from this previously exited company and apply all of our knowledge and experience to extracts that have such an amazing ability to help so many people. That's really what drew me to the plant and or the fungus, or what drew me to this industry.
And Ben, you mentioned that when you first kicked off with Filament Health, that there weren't many folks who were focusing on naturally derived psychedelics. Instead, lots of companies have opted to go down the synthetic route. Why do you think that is? What's the reason do you think that other folks have gone left when you've gone right?
I think there are many factors at play. One of the primary reasons is historical. So as we know, Albert Hofmann, the first, I guess you could say, Western person to, you know, really identify and describe, you know, obviously the, you know, the indigenous practices and the indigenous use of these substances goes back much, much further than Albert Hofmann. But let's just say that Albert Hofmann was the first, you know, Western pharmaceutical chemist to identify and describe these substances. He was a synthetic chemist, and he very quickly developed methods to synthesize these compounds in his lab and patented them. And those methods are, by and large, still in use today. These compounds are, frankly speaking, relatively easy to synthesize. They're not, and we're talking about the classical psychedelics here. They're relatively easy to manufacture synthetically. And so I think that's one of the main reasons, right? It became commonplace very quickly to manufacture them through synthesis. Also, remember that these were, you know, this was a pharmaceutical synthetic chemist. The pharmaceutical industry, especially in the West, has a real preference for synthetic substances because it's easy, it's repeatable. All you have to do is buy, you know, base chemicals from the chemical supplier and get a reactor and, you know, combine them and do the different steps, and you're going to get the same product every single time. And there's a real advantage to that when you're manufacturing something like a pharmaceutical product that needs to be highly standardized, highly precise, you know, GMP. Mm-hmm. But again, you know, we believe something is lost through that process, right? I think the main reason is that, you know, the synthesis is easy and natural extraction is relatively more difficult, especially in an industry and in a culture where, you know, for the longest time there was in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, something that was, you know, synthetic and plastic and manufactured, that was considered good, right? You could remove the natural variability. What could be better than that? But over time, we are learning that perhaps the natural variability and perhaps, as I mentioned before, the, you know, all the presence of all these other compounds that are in the mushroom and in the plant, perhaps that they can provide a benefit, perhaps.
So you're talking about some sort of perhaps entourage effect or synergistic enhancements.
Exactly. After all, these compounds did evolve in nature for some reason, right? Over millions, hundreds of millions, or maybe even billions of years. So to simply just identify what we believe is the primary active ingredient, you know, say psilocybin, and completely ignore all of these other compounds, well, I mean, that's a pretty bold assumption, pretty bold statement. So, and that's why, you know, again, why we decided to focus on natural to for the first time to look at, you know, some of these other compounds and whether they have an effect either in combination with each other or alone in isolation.
And Ben, with over 100 known psychedelic plants and probably a similar number of mushrooms with psychoactive properties, which of these, I guess, yet to be researched compounds do you believe to be the most potentially fascinating to investigate and why?
That is a great question. So many of these compounds have yet to be studied. In fact, it's important to remember that no FDA-authorized clinical trial has ever employed the use of naturally sourced psychedelic substances. Our trial that, as you mentioned, we're working with University of California, San Francisco, was actually the very first natural psychedelic clinical trial to get authorization. So this is a very important question that's, you know, only going to, the very beginnings of the answer are only just going to be start to be answered in the next couple of months. But getting back to your question, the compound that I think I'm most excited about that we are looking at currently is a compound called psilocin. There doesn't seem to be any standard pronunciation.
A sort of potato potato moment.
Potato potato, tomato tomato, et cetera, et cetera. Canada, America, Britain, UK. Psilocin is the active form of psilocybin. Psilocybin needs to convert into psilocin before it becomes active in the human body. Both psilocin and psilocybin are, by the way, produced by the magic mushroom. But since psilocin is an unstable compound, especially when you manufacture it synthetically, in fact, Albert Hofmann, in his original process, he actually makes psilocin, but because psilocin is unstable, he actually adds a phosphate protecting group. Sorry for the chemistry lesson. He adds a phosphate protecting group to psilocin to render it stable. But what that also does is turns the psilocin into psilocybin. So because of this, and because all research so far has been done with synthetic substances, it's all been done with synthetic psilocybin and not with psilocin. But you can imagine that there are certain benefits to the direct administration of psilocin. Because you don't have to wait for the body, which the body naturally converts, the human body naturally converts the psilocybin into psilocin, you know, that conversion takes time. So we can perhaps expect that directly administering psilocin may have a faster onset time and a shorter overall duration. That conversion is thought to primarily occur in the gut and may be associated with some of the stomach upset that we know is a common side effect of psilocybin consumption. So again, by directly administering the psilocin, maybe we can avoid some of the stomach upset. And thirdly, it's known that in these kinds of drug conversions, that different people have different amounts of the enzymes necessary to convert these drugs from the prodrug to the active form. That's what this process is called. Psilocybin is actually called a prodrug, and psilocin is actually the drug. But since different people convert it differently, and some perhaps may not convert it at all, it could be responsible for what we see are the wide variability of effects when you give people oral psilocybin. For all of these reasons, we think that psilocin is an ideal candidate to study clinically. And I think just because of the fact that we're manufacturing it naturally and we identified it right away as a natural compound that came out of the mushroom, we thought, well, we'd better make a drug product out of this. And so we did. So that's the compound that we are probably most excited about at this time. Another project that we're working on is a very interesting product is trying to make a stable ayahuasca formulation. What's fascinating about ayahuasca is that it's currently given out as an extract, right? The shaman makes a brew or a decoction, which is essentially a water extract, a tea of different herbs, but it's completely unstandardized, right? You don't know exactly how much of the DMT, which is the primary active compound, and you don't know how much of the harmaline or the beta carbolines are in there, which serve to prevent the breakdown of the DMT in the body. I think ayahuasca is just so fascinating that these indigenous people managed to discover that. They managed to discover through trial and error that DMT is unstable in the human body and breaks down via monoamine oxidase, and that you need to have this other herb which contains a monoamine oxidase inhibitor, and unless you take the two together, the one containing the DMT is not active. I mean, it boggles your mind how amazing that is to make that discovery, and so we're seeking to, you know, kind of improve that just a little bit by applying stabilization and standardization, so that when people consume ayahuasca, they can be very confident in the dose that they have, and try to increase consistency. Because of course, if we want to have any kind of broader use or broader deregulation, you know, consistency and standardization of dose is extremely important, if not the most important thing for any treatment if it's going to pass muster in a clinical setting.
And on that point, so you mentioned about perhaps creating a standardized ayahuasca formulation. Now, with your knowledge of ayahuasca, how it's taken the sort of deep ceremonial practices that are often are entrenched in an ayahuasca ceremony. How do you see perhaps a stable, standardized form of ayahuasca bridging the gap between sort of the traditional ceremonial setting and what we know as sort of modern medicine?
That is the crux of what we are attempting to try to contribute. Obviously, we are not ever going to be any kind of replacement for all of the tradition and all of the ceremony and all of the rich history. We're botanical extraction and standardization experts. We are not shamans or traditional entheogenic practitioners. But what I think we can provide through providing a standardized product, whether that product is consumed as a liquid, similar to what's already consumed, or maybe it's consumed as a tablet, I think with some relatively minor changes, rather than a shaman producing a brew right in front of you, which the shaman, you know, in order to judge to assess the potency of the brew that he's making, actually tastes it, which is obviously a not very accurate way of assessing the DMT content of a water extract of an herb. If we could, you know, somehow provide a standardized product where the shaman, the participants, everybody knows what dose they're getting, that it's a safe dose, right? That it's not too much, it's not too little, that it's been made under GMP conditions. So the plants are sustainably harvested and grown and traceable, that no other plants are in there by accident, that no other unwanted chemicals or any other things are in there that you wouldn't want to consume. I think what we would be able to provide is a lot of extra comfort to all involved, that the dose and the product that they were getting was standardized and safe. And I think having participants in the ceremony that are more at ease because they know that the product, like I said, is safe and standardized, I think that can probably contribute to better outcomes for everybody and a safer experience. And I think that's probably something even the most, you know, hardcore traditionalists would probably be on board with, better outcomes for everybody.
And you mentioned there a few times sort of about products being standardized, safe, earlier in our conversation when talking about sort of perhaps why other folks have leaned towards synthetic compounds. One of the reasons you mentioned is that, you know, it's easier to create stable, consistent products when they are synthetic. Obviously, you guys have gone down the natural route, especially when you're talking about the psilocin earlier on. Now, when you are going down this naturally derived psychedelics route, what methodologies are out there for extracting the psychedelic compounds from this natural material? You know, what techniques are people using? How do these work? And I guess which one of these techniques will lead to the most pure, safe, standardized product, because, you know, that's the silver bullet.
So when you're extracting a compound, any compound from natural sources, typically what you do is a solvent extraction, and that means you use some kind of a solvent to dissolve the active ingredients from the plant and remove them from the plant substance, which then allows you to do further purification, or perhaps you're doing a simple full spectrum extract, and perhaps that liquid extract will be your final product. Maybe it's a tincture. The solvents that you can use, and when I use solvent, that's not necessarily a dirty word. Like when you make a cup of tea or a cup of coffee, water in that case is the solvent, right? Solvent doesn't necessarily mean it's a toxic chemical. There are certainly toxic solvents, but just because something is a solvent doesn't mean that it's necessarily toxic. Canola oil can be used as a solvent as well for certain things. The solvent that you can use is governed by the nature of the target compound that you wish to extract, and usually by something called the polarity. The polarity of a substance governs what solvent you need to use also in terms of its polarity. So to give you an example, you know, oily substances have low polarities. For instance, cannabinoids, which are oils, need to be extracted similarly with an oily solvent, a solvent of low polarity. This is why you have solvents such as hexane, which is also an oil, it's a low polarity solvent, can be used to extract or butane or propane. All of these are low polarity solvents, which are well suited to extract cannabinoids. The psychedelics, the classical psychedelics are different. They're compounds that are called alkaloids, and they're generally quite polar. And that means that you can use highly polar solvents. These would be things like water, ethanol, methanol, which are, you know, very readily available and very, very common extraction solvents for a wide variety of different compounds. So we use a variety of different extraction solvents depending on what the desired outcome is. You know, whether we want to have a little bit more of this compound or that compound come out of the plant, we'll use a different combination. It also depends on, you know, in other industries, you know, if the product is intended to be used as a dietary supplement, you may have a certain choice of solvents. Whereas if you have a product that's intended for use as a pharmaceutical product, you again have a different set of solvents that you could use. Also, an important factor is whether you are going to purify the compound and isolate the compound. If you are going to make isolated natural psilocybin, for instance, it doesn't really matter what solvent you use, because at the end of the day, the product that you're making is going to be 99 or 98% pure psilocybin, and there's really not going to be much of anything else left in that product. But if you're going to make a product that is not an isolated product like that, and therefore contains some of the other compounds naturally present in the plants, you might end up wanting to choose different solvents from your base extraction. So we don't publicly disclose exactly what the combinations of solvents that we use are. That's obviously part of our trade secrets. Mm-hmm. But I will say that a number of different combinations work, and we use different ones based on what the desired outcome is.
Now, building relationships and having a good line of communication with regulators, indeed, is no mean feat, and perhaps something that many organizations struggle with. For you guys, how do you engage with bodies such as, say, Health Canada, and what advice would you give to other business leaders looking to develop or perhaps deepen their relationships with these organizations?
It's another fascinating question. For better or for worse, we exist at the mercy of the regulators. these substances are, for the most part, all controlled substances. It's important to remind listeners that they're not illegal, right? They're not banned substances. They're controlled substances, which means it is legal to work with them. You just have to have mountains and mountains of permits and paperwork and all these different things. So far, I think it's fair to say we enjoy a very productive relationship with Health Canada, with FDA. We're quite pleased that many of the things that we propose to them seem to have been met with approval. For instance, we have what's called a dealer's license, which is the thing that's necessary to manufacture controlled substances like psilocybin. We have recently several clinical trials in Canada and the US gained authorization to proceed that are going to be administering our substances. But I also agree with what you said, that there do seem to be many people, groups out there that are struggling to get in a good footing or present themselves in a favorable light to the authorities. I think that the key in our communication has been open honesty. We approached Health Canada with a plan that, you know, we were a bunch of folks that had previously worked together in Health Canada regulated industries, mm-hmm. That were experts in botanical extraction. And our plan was to, you know, grow magic mushrooms and develop the technology necessary for making stable, standardized pharmaceutical grade products out of them for the first time. And that seemed to, I mean, we don't have any real insight on what the internal machinations were that led to us getting these kinds of approvals. But all I can say is that, you know, whenever there was a question, we answered it openly and honestly, and it seemed to have worked. So I would I would encourage people to get in a dialogue with Health Canada or FDA as early as possible, as often as possible. These are human beings working there, right? There are, although sometimes it doesn't seem that way, there are human beings working in these large faceless offices. By and large, it seems like they want to help. I mean, Health Canada recently restored access to restricted drugs through the Special Access Program. You know, it's not a full-scale legal market by any stretch of the imagination. What it is, it's a signal that Health Canada is listening and watching and seeing the accumulation of very good evidence in support of the safety and efficacy of these substances and recognition that some of its own policies were flawed. So, you know, I think it's important to not bite the hand that feeds us, so to speak, and kind of work within the confines of the system that we have, because I think that's going to be probably easier and faster to get these products out into the hands of those people that need them. It's probably going to be a faster way than all out war with them, right? Although the all out war approach is, you know, there's definitely many proponents, and you see a kind of a shade of that approach with various ballot measures and state house initiatives in the United States, for sure.
And Ben, as our time starts drawing to a close, earlier we touched upon the clinical trial that you're embarking on, looking at the effects of naturally derived psilocin. Would you be able to tell our listeners a little bit more about when this will commence and how they can, well, track the progress of what's going on here?
This trial, we're very excited about it. It's actually going to be comparing our naturally extracted psilocin product to our naturally extracted psilocybin product. And what we're hoping to show is that the psilocin product will have benefits compared to the psilocybin product. We don't know. The only way to discover this is through experimentation. The trial received approval to proceed in November of last year and is currently scheduled to begin dosing in March next month down in San Francisco. I would say the best way to follow along with the progress would be to go to our website, filament.health, and sign up for our mailing list where we distribute regular updates about the progress.
Awesome. Well, I can't wait to, well, can't wait to see how it pans out. And for the time being, the clock has beaten us. So I would like to say, Ben, thank you so much for joining us on Professionally Psychedelics.
You're very welcome. It was a pleasure.